Hello and welcome to this discussing episode. And today's episode, we are talking travelling players in early modern England, civic spaces and provincial performance. Because there's something that always happens when people are talking about early modern performance. There's a certain focus that seems to happen all the time, is that there's this city called London where apparently everything happened, and everything happened in circular spaces, and that's how all theatre happened, and it was all outside, and everyone was happy. And that's the general shape of what a lot of people tend to think early modern playing was like. Of course, early modern playing happened everywhere. It comes from a long tradition where people are playing in found spaces, alternative spaces, all around the country, up and down the country, from the medieval period onwards, in different scales and in different ways, from different levels of amateurishness and professionalism. And that had been going on since time immemorial. And to a degree, me and my guest are going to be trying to explode some of those myths and look at the wider picture of players on tour, what happened to them, and what the audiences made of such things. So without further ado, I will ask my guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Well, hi, thanks for having me on the podcast today. I'm Dr. Will Green. I'm a research fellow at the University of Nottingham, and I'm currently specialising in a research project with the Guildhall at Stratford-upon-Avon, looking at the building's use by travelling players on tour outside of London during the latter half of the 16th century and slightly into the start of the 17th century, with a view to setting up a new permanent exhibition here at the Guildhall, which, this might be a bold claim, I believe to be the first permanent exhibition outside of London focusing on early modern drama as an art that happened, as Rob said, everywhere.
Mm. So let's start with this specific place. So Stratford-upon-Avon Guildhall as regional theatre venue. What is the space actually like? Was like then as to and like today in that sense? What kind of conditions might a player encounter over many hundreds of years potentially here? What's the sort of earliest point of the venue coming into being?
Well, this building was constructed around 1418 to 1420. It was primarily the base for Stratford-upon-Avon's Guild of the Holy Cross, which would have been a religious guild, a lot of tradespeople who could protect their interests through membership. So it was a very important space for the town. As a building, it has two floors. The lower floor is a very busy space, which throughout history has contained all sorts of places, a court of record, a chapel area, a counting house. And upstairs, you have an unusual, relatively unusual situation for an early modern medieval guild hall, in that it housed a schoolroom, whereas a lot of these guild halls would have housed a jail. The upstairs space also has quite a sizable room that could be used for a variety of council events and could be quite flexible. It's a building where there's a lot of potential for things to go on, but it's not as huge as a London theatre. It has a lot of spaces, but if a player were to come here and decide how are we going to perform, it is missing a lot. A lot of things you might want to have. And if you're thinking of spaces to perform in, a lot of the rooms are sizable, but they're still probably at most half the size of a London theatre. So there's a lot going on here, but also a lot of flexibility would be required depending on what you wanted to use this building for.
So what sort of capacity would a playing company be looking at being able to draw in and fit within a space? I mean, we can ignore health and safety because it doesn't exist yet.
Yeah. If you're coming to a regional theatre venue, a venue where you could use for regional theatre, it could vary from town to town quite dramatically. I have been reliably informed that the most likely performance space in the Stratford-upon-Avon Guildhall has been able to hold 300 people in, but that would mean that there's no space for acting out your play. So at most, you would probably be lucky if you got 100 people comfortably sitting in a room like that. It's going to be lower than that. You could have as few as 60 to 100. it's not the sort of audience that you might be dragging out of London theatre for sure.
And going a little earlier than the period we're going to be talking about primarily here, if we're thinking back into the medieval, into that late 15th century sort of setting where theatre is produced for found spaces, the local mystery morality plays, that kind of theatre is designed for the space often that you're going to find yourself in. There is some touring for groups that does occur, and certainly interlude playing is designed for small spaces. When we get into that, those touring Tudor interludes that we know about in the early 16th century, the cry of room, room as an actor comes on is because these spaces are so small. And so, even if an acting company at that time may only have four or five, maybe six people in it, they don't necessarily need much space. They expect the spaces to be slightly too cramped to actually perform comfortably in. And that's in a sense a norm that the theatre that we're going to start talking about will inherit and then necessarily have to perhaps squeeze to adapt as playing gets a little more established. We're starting from 1560, I believe. Is that so?
Well, my earliest record is 1568.
So Queen Elizabeth is on the throne, has been on the throne for a little while. And as I say, I've mentioned already that we've got touring, relatively small scale touring companies are prevalent. They're about. What starts changing during Elizabeth's reign with touring and with companies?
As drama becomes more what you might describe as secular entertainment, it becomes what some people might view as a more professionalized industry. It's less community based than it might have been. You have people who are really taking on the profession of acting as a way of making a living. The big problem for this would be, of course, the Vagabond Act of the early 1570s, when it effectively becomes a requirement for acting companies to have a royal or noble patron, which then effectively gives them, the right to perform throughout the land. But it does mean that theatre starts to become a lot more closely regulated. Depending on who you ask, this is either a very bad thing or a very good thing, because some people might say, if theatre is more regulated, then players are more protected in a way of making livelihood. They can't really be accused of being vagabonds on the road because they are protected by the Queen or the Earl of Worcester or the Earl of Leicester. On the other hand, it does mean that theatre in areas that we might call the provinces, that becomes something where people, unless they're regularly travelling to London, you effectively have to wait for theatre to come to you. And that makes it something that will be very exciting, I'm sure. But it does mean that when we're looking at records of players visiting certain towns, they're very spread out over several years. You might get a couple of playing troops in a single year, or none at all, or you might not get a single playing troop travelling to your town for 8 years.
And of course, we also got to remember at this particular point in our timeline is that London theatres themselves are not necessarily very big. The ones that exist, again, and are to a degree found spaces that are being adapted for use. And that's not a criticism. That's just the way things worked. So the space at Stratford-upon-Avon, but also countless other guild halls or other found spaces around the country that inns that would take in touring players would actually have relatively comparable spaces, but with additional party quirks every time. There isn't a door here. There is you have to go via X to get to Y, and that would be normal until later when bigger playhouses get established in London and to a degree elsewhere.
It makes it a challenge when you're going to a variety of spaces and you nominally have permission through your patronage to perform throughout England. But that doesn't change the fact that when you arrive in a town, very commonly, playing troops would have to put on a licensing performance for members of that town's town council. That could be at the mayor's house, or it could take place in the heart of a town's civic governance. So for many towns like Stratford, that would be the Guildhall. Then, even if you get permission to perform, where are you going to be performing? Is it going to be a very small space? Have you got everything that you had in the previous town? If you went to Leicester, there are so many staging possibilities in that town's guild hall. If you come to Stratford, well, if you've got a play that involves a balcony, you can't use it because there isn't anything like that. So it becomes a time when you're really waiting to find out where are you going to be able to perform? Are you going to be able to perform? What's the space going to be like if you are able to perform? Will it require a huge amount of adaptation or will you be able to make do? It's a real art form being able to think on your feet in this manner. If you're trying to perform in the Stratford Guildhall, how are you going to do backstage? That becomes very challenging because there aren't that many, aren't that many conveniently placed doorways, let's just say that.
And it's also looking at the text that we have for that sort of end of Elizabethan drama is playing companies start growing. They start getting larger. We've talked about that sort of baseline of five or six. You know, the numbers start creeping up, and the expectation of stage effects or stage mechanics or props seems to increase over time. And that's one of these questions about touring. It's easy enough to a degree if you're just touring with five of you and you've got a sword or two and to take with you. But what do you do when you need to increase the scale of what you're doing? And it's not happening overnight necessarily. It's happening over a number of years. So what are the sort of the practicalities for being on tour, especially at a time when potentially some of these playing companies don't actually have a base anywhere, that they are theatreless performers?
Yeah. So what should we discuss first in response to that? Because I can think of two avenues to go down. But one, practicalities of how do you survive while touring. The other being the practicalities of actually using these spaces. What would you
Well,
prefer first?
let's start with survival.
Okay.
If we survive survival, then we can move on.
Well, survival is a really interesting question because it actually ties into that earlier, actually both of these avenues of discussion tie into the point earlier you were making about that baseline of five or six and companies growing in size. Because obviously expenses are changing throughout the period, but one of the things that's quite clear for a touring company is that you are not necessarily being supported and funded by your patron to go on these tours. So you need to be able to have your outgoing expenses and then hopefully recoup that as time goes on, as your tour continues. The average we could say for, say, the 1580s could be a cost of 1 shilling per person per day for food and lodging, plus extra costs for storing your carts you might have taken with you, or feeding and boarding your horses. So that at a time when you could theoretically be charging as little as a penny per person to come and see your play, you really need to be maximizing your profits on tour. So one of the things that we do know acting companies did is it seems that a lot of them would have reduced the number of actors that were performing in a play. They might have had a particular group of actors at a time who you could consider to be the touring contingent. And we know this because there are some early title pages of published plays which actually give advice for how you might perform this play on tour. There's a play by Thomas Garter called Godly Susanna, which has a title page which tells us that eight persons may easily play it, and actually provides a doubling slash tripling chart on the front cover to explain how that would work. So that does raise the question of if you're a company like the Queen's Men, who specialise in history plays with huge cast numbers that those plays might require, there is compromise involved and there is cutting involved. Because one, the spaces might not be big enough, but two, can you really have a full company and be affording to pay a shilling per person per day to take everyone on tour? It could be disastrous. And it was disastrous for some companies like Pembroke's Men, who went on a 10-month tour in 1592 to three and ended up going bust as a result. So it's a difficult thing to navigate the practicalities of touring in that sense.
Yeah, and a number of play texts that survive to us do come with these sort of conditional elements to them. I mean, even going back to interludes, there's a John Rastall play which sort of goes, if it needs to last under an hour, you can cut this bit. So there is that sense that on tour that these plays are flexible. That the often the scripts that come to us are sort of the best case scenario of something, and we do have Certainly instances of actors playing on their feet and figuring out how to work around things. We've got the Tartan story of someone being sick and he had to step in and play effectively two characters in the same scene and hit himself. Now, that's an exaggeration probably for comic effect. But it's also not unknown in modern theatre. And we also think about there is much less touring theatre than there used to be. But, you know, big companies taking a smaller company out on tour from the main house is not, even today, is not an unusual way of working.
No, and it's a great way of, you know, if you're an Elizabethan company and plague is ravaging London, it's a great way, if you have a good tour, of continuing to make money. Yes, it's hard, but it might be the best way of staying afloat. And I think that when you're given that choice, you know, however long this plague outbreak is going to last, can we just sit through it and write some plays and then open again in the spring? Or do we go on tour in the winter? It's weighing them up.
And of course, some companies are primarily designed for touring. That's actually what they do. That they may spend some time in London, but they don't frequent a specific house necessarily. That, you know, that's touring is their life. As opposed to some companies which established themselves slightly later in the time of Elizabeth's reign, who basically established themselves in London and might tour, but actually that's not what they're very interested in. And there's an ecology of playing companies of different scales doing different things. It's that question of other ways of making money as they go on tour as well, because it's not just the civic spaces. They can also... someone's just brought it up in the chat, that they can visit houses of wealthy patrons or elsewhere along the route. They can perform in some places in multiple venues once they've played to the great and the good in an initial performance. And of course, they can be paid to go away.
Yeah.
like a Hollywood scriptwriter who's never had their scripts filmed, it's hypothetically possible to go on tour and never do a show.
Yeah, it's very strange to think that actually some of these towns, as places became more and more Puritan in the provinces as the time went on, you do get some towns who write these awful, scathing records of these players came to the town and they were bringing sin and depravity and trying to corrupt the people of our town. And then it'll just say, so we paid them so many pounds to go away. So in a sense, that's at least still some kind of win. You got some money without having to do too much other than offend people just by being.
And I think that there's also, you know, the local institutions that may be interested groups that would be interested in seeing drama performed, and there's sort of evidence that, you know, certainly schools and universities that, you know, they're very interested in drama. We talked about guilds. We've been talking about religious guilds, but of course there are guilds in trades that obviously were very interested in drama because they were producing it. As Elizabeth's reign goes on, they do a lot less of that. But you would have thought that they're still quite interested in drama, that, you know, people around the country are interested in drama because they used to do it a lot as well. So I wonder if there's some sort of nostalgia factor that comes in. I used to do some acting. Sorry, I am now thinking aloud and moving on a tangent. There's nothing to do with what we discussed before we started.
It's interesting because, I mean, for the Stratford Guildhall, we know that drama, classical drama, was a big part of that schooling tradition, humanist schooling in England, and having your schoolhouse within your guild hall, there's plenty of people who have that connection to drama. Now, the makeup of this building might suggest quite strongly that when travelling players are being played host to, school might be cancelled because it would be in the way. But drama could still be, you know, some people were very positive about drama as being a way of experiencing biblical stories or learning about history. And of course, others thought it was a terrible sin and just shouldn't be anywhere within 1,000 miles of the town.
That practicality of surviving, of going out on the road, we do have references to I think the Queen's Men and possibly, does Leicester Men do it as well? Companies that not only send a smaller contingent out, but they literally just sort of split themselves in two and move off, which again is a question popping up in the chat. If a larger company only sent a contingent of actors out on tour, would there be the A team or the B team, do you think? So who goes
possibly
out on tour? Do you take out one group of really good people and leave the really rubbish people somewhere else?
That's what I do.
Or do you mix and match?
I mean, you've got a much more stable theatrical life in London. So you could probably cope with your B team staying in London, because we know that Richard Tarlton, who was with Leicester's Men, I think he was with Leicester's Men first and later the Queen's Men. Mm. We know he travelled as far north as Edinburgh. And he's a star performer. So it does seem like put your best people on the road. And that might be not just because do we want a big name to attract a crowd. It could be something as simple as you have to be very adaptable on tour. You want people who really know their stuff. And that might mean that are apprentice boy players touring, or do you just have the best of them? Or do you just have your superior adult actors? You know, it's a question, but we do know that Tarlton was travelling quite extensively. So I would say that if you are splitting it up, take your best on tour.
Well, it also potentially depends on who likes touring. I mean, a company of actors could be a mix of people, and some people maybe aren't really up to touring. I mean, the early modern theatre game is often a young person's game because it's so demanding. But on tour, it may be physically demanding, but your repertoire is smaller than the sort of never-ending grind of London, which is demanding that you turn over your play every day and a new play turning up every 3-4 weeks or something. On tour, you probably only go out with half a dozen titles at most, and that'll do a town and then you can move on. So there's different kinds of wear and tear for surviving on tour.
Yeah, I mean, we know that there were cases where, well, at least one case I'm aware of, where one company's actor wrote to another company asking if they could borrow some of their plays because no one seemed to like the plays they'd taken on tour. So in theory, you know, if the demand for new plays in London is insatiable and you're constantly, you know, you've got a couple of plays, if Thomas Middleton, it wasn't going to be that long before I said Thomas Middleton, was it?
No. You've done very well.
If Thomas Middleton's A Game at Chess is the longest running play of this period at 9 days, we know that plays are changing rapidly. But theoretically, going on tour could give you a chance to keep making money from theatrical properties that you've exhausted in London. Mm. Because outside of London, you could assume most people haven't seen it. Mm. So it gives you more time to work with a small set of plays. When Pembroke's Men went bankrupt, they had to sell off a good chunk of their touring repertory at the time. And that consists of 4 plays. So if we could say that you're taking 4 plays on tour, some would be better in certain places than elsewhere. But it gives these actors time to really work with a small set of plays. And in a sense, that's a bit closer to a lot of theatre companies' experience now, when you can really work with a play and get to know it a bit better. Let's put on something new every couple of days continuously.
Yeah. So let's move on to that second part of that question of the practicalities of getting plays around. Now, I was saying earlier, you know, and earlier in the period, it's not so logistically complicated because it's a matter of getting human bodies to travel X number of miles each day. Mm. With a certain amount of baggage. But as the plays get larger and more complex, the logistics presumably get more complex as well, as, you know, how do you, if you're doing Tamburlaine the Great, how do you get that chariot? or do you put your props on it?
We have to assume that this was a very different type of playgoing experience if you're in the audience. Mm. I wouldn't say that going on tour was a case of compromise exactly, because especially when it was a thing that people were doing regularly, people were prepared to do it and people knew, and it was a skill being able to know what you can do with a play, going into a space and thinking, right, we did this yesterday in this place, but it won't work here. That's quite a talent in itself. But this is one of the reasons why it seems that guild halls in particular were favored by touring troupes. Firstly, because of the size of them, because then they're not They're not the size of like the Fortune Playhouse, but they're at least comparable in their dimensions. They have rooms that work as theatre spaces. They also, a lot of them have armories in. And we know that when Pembroke's men performed in Bath, they were fined because they broke a bow, which they'd borrowed from the armory in that Guildhall. So you can access props. That's a good thing. So on the one hand, you might be having people saying, okay, when I come in and tell you that I'm the Earl of Warwick, you have to believe that I'm the Earl of Warwick, even if I'm not dressed because we haven't got all of our costumes with us. But they're probably using weapons they borrowed. And in the Stratford Guildhall, the Queen's men were fined 9 pence in 1587 for breaking a form, which was a sort of wooden bench that would have been used for children to sit on in the schoolhouse part of the building. So they're borrowing props to maybe use as a way of having different levels in the performance. How they broke it, they're very sturdy. We don't know how they broke it. That's a mystery. Maybe they all jumped on it at some point.
Yeah, actors that
You know, all
it's
together.
it's yeah, things get broken. That's what happens.
But it's a challenge, you know. You've got to be able to think on your feet, and the practicality of using these spaces change all the time. So that's why people prefer a guild hall. And we know that there's lots of evidence that the guild hall was the place you wanted to be.
Because they're acoustically reasonably consistent. You've
There's
you
good
don't
lighting.
yeah you've got a space that is, I say, you were saying, is it, they tend to be relatively comparable spaces. They will vary slightly in their dimensions, but you will generally be able to pitch the audience in a certain direction, actors in a certain direction. Exits will be reasonably consistent. And just returning as to where I started from, all of these spaces are square.
Yes, which is very important.
This is yeah, so many theatrical spaces of the period. Most plays happen in square rooms. Just gonna throw that out there. For those who really love round spaces and their importance in their lives. Okay, we've been throwing a lot of playing companies' names around, and obviously after Rogues and Vagabonds, the title of whose troupe it is becomes so important, and we start getting names that start seeming familiar, but there are also an awful lot of names that you're sort of going, who are they? Because if you're on tour, you're not necessarily getting the zeitgeist that London gives you, and the the plays that you're doing may not be recorded as well. So who are some of these companies? Who's on the road?
Well, if you're looking in the Stratford records, big names pop up relatively frequently. There are about 35 visits in total over the 1568 to 1622 period. And Leicester's men, they turn up 5 times. The Queen's men, they turn up 5 times. Worcester's men, they're here quite a lot. Then you'll get to records like 1582, when there's a record called Shandoes Men. Now, that seems to be a troupe patronised by Lord Chandos, who was based at Sudley Castle. It's not that far away from Stratford. But that's not a name you're going to be reading in the great annals of the early modern theatre companies. It seems to it only pops up once in these records. We know nothing about who was in that troupe or what they performed, what kind of plays they had. It seems to have been of benefit to certain noblemen to be able to say, I am patronising an acting company, and they went to Stratford. Lord Chandos has Queen Elizabeth I visit him a lot to the point that he goes bankrupt, actually. It might have been worth his while maintaining some kind of company of players. Then you'll end up with companies called Bartlett's Men. Again, no idea. I can't tell you much about that company whatsoever. But there's some that are also interesting distinctions. In Stratford, you have Essex's Men do arrive, as does the Countess of Essex's Men. So that's a separate troupe. And that's an interesting thing to think of. Two different people, both Essex's men, but one they specify as the Countess of Essex's men. So it's an interesting thing to think that you're in this town, you might be thinking, I really love Leicester's men. Leicester has got such a great influence in Warwickshire, and Leicester's men come so often. And then you find out Shandoes men are playing at the Guildhall. Well, it's theatre, but they don't seem to have that big repertoire or reputation behind them. Then again, you get other companies like Worcester's Men, which are They mainly tour. They are mainly on the Midland circuit. So that's a name that's going to be cropping up in towns a lot because they're not really going to London. That's an ever-changing company. So there's so many companies that just keep appearing. Somewhere you could be like, read Laurie Johnston's book on Leicester's Men. We know so much about that company. I wonder who'll write the book on Lord Chandos's Men.
Just a note on Laurie Johnson's book. I have interviewed him for the podcast. It hasn't come out yet. It is, I think, available for our patrons. It's a very good book, by the way, and very much digs into on a fairly granular level the what's going on with Leicester's Men, accompanying a number of company studies books that have really tried to dig into what different playing companies are doing. And they're very confusing playing companies because their patron will die and they'll get a different name, but they'll sort of still be the same company, or they'll get their people poached from another company. So it's like, well, is it really a different company if 70% of the company is actually the same as a different company, but some of them are different? At what point do we make those distinctions and those differentiations? So we've mentioned the Queen's Men rather a lot. The Queen's Men, founded in 1583, who Queen Elizabeth basically poaches all the best players. I mean, it's the dirty dozen of the theatrical world, including Tartan, we mentioned earlier. It's this super group of actors. And then we think about theatre ecology today. We've got the National, we've got the RSC, and then we've got smaller regional houses, and then there are people who specifically all they do is tour on a slightly different level. But at a time of when patronage matters so much, the letter you turn up with the seal and saying this, we've got permission to perform, we are an official group, beyond the fact that sometimes these documents are forged. Yeah, we've definitely got perform. Yeah, we've definitely got a patron, mate.
Allegedly.
Absolutely. Nudge, nudge. That these groups turn up, and it might be that when they say, no, you're not the playing company we want, or we had Queen's Men last week.
Or there's another company already here.
That there is a marketplace, that there are people in competition on tour, in complex ways that we probably can't fully ever uncover.
And so much, there's such a political side to this because you wouldn't see this so much if you're going to, say, the Swan or the Fortune, because you know where you're going and you kind of know who you're seeing. But when a company arrives in a provincial town, how do they make their identity known? Well, they're marching through the area, waving the banner. That's unmistakable when you see a particular banner coming. You know whether that's Leicester's Men, Worcester's Men, or the Queen herself. Makes it quite curious to think that as these records go on, whoever takes over as the scribe on the council really stops caring, because at 1586 is the first time we have a record that just says players came. And then in 1587, when we know that there's six visits in that year, there's the Queen's Men twice, Essex's, Leicester's, Stafford's Men, and then another company. This gets frustrating, but then you start to wonder, who are these people? Because surely they have a patron associated with them, but why is that just not of interest?
We've got people on tour. We've got companies on tour. We've got a question in the chat, which I genuinely don't know the answer to for some instances. Do you know if playwrights toured? Are they keeping in touch with how their plays are going down in the country, as well as, because we all know what plays play differently in different venues. I mean, you think you've got a hit and you transfer somewhere and it dies a death. Are playwrights out on the road, do we think?
This is an interesting question. There are theories about certain playwrights. Playwrights know a lot about the practicalities of touring. Should we go for Thomas Middleton again? I mean, the first record of him, he's daily accompanying the players. So that's interesting. And then when he comes to write A Mad World, My Masters, there's this wonderful discussion between two characters about travelling players. There's a character in it called Service, who says, there are certain players come to town, sir. And Sir Bounty's Progress says, players, they'll grace my entertainment well, but for certain players, there thou liest, boy. They were never more uncertain in their lives, now up and now down, knowing not when to play, where to play, nor what to play, when to play for fearful fools, where to play for Puritan fools. So that really encapsulates all of the difficulties on the road. So that's a playwright who really knows what's going on. So there doesn't seem to be a division between playwrights writing the plays and then the actors performing them. Playwrights know what the experiences the playwrights are having on the road. They know the practicalities and the problems with touring. That just leaves us wondering how many playwrights themselves actually went on tour. And that's not documented. But I would say that if you're a playwright who started out as an actor, like Ben Jonson, odds are they toured at some point. There's a nice crossover here. But I couldn't say for certain, in this particular town, Ben Jonson was here.
Obviously, lots of things happen on tour, which things that happen on tour stay on tour most of the time. So, any sort of success stories and horror stories I have noted down here. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. What have we got?
Well, the great successes are the companies that manage to survive. If you're going on an extended tour and you're coming back and you're still afloat and you're in profit, fantastic. That's the success story. The horror stories, we don't have that many accounts of people's experiences on tour, but we know that some players, playing companies really left an impression on people. For example, there's a chap called Richard Willis, who I think in the 1630s or maybe 40s, he writes fondly about his recollection of seeing a play called The Cradle of Security being performed in Gloucester. That's leaving a lasting impression. And that's something nice for whichever company performed that. Then you get I mentioned Pembroke's Men going bankrupt and having to sell off a selection of plays. That includes Marlowe's Edward II, so it's a very nice property to have. The Queen's Men had possibly the biggest horror story of them all because they performed in Thame in Oxfordshire in 1587, I believe it was. And two of the actors there, John Towne and William Nell, I believe their names were, got into a fight and Towne killed Nell. He stabbed him. So that really affects the company because they're now down some men. They have Towne. He's still around, but he's been pardoned because it's self-defense, but he's in prison having to wait his official pardon. So the company has to go on without him. That shows an extreme example of something bad that could happen to a company. But if you're on tour for a long time and tensions are running high, I mean, are we surprised? There was obviously some bad blood between them, but that's got to be the pinnacle of the horror story for a
Well,
company.
I mean,
Oh
Queen's Men have form. I mean, pretty much
yeah.
the moment they were formed and they went on tour, someone dies in at the box office point because someone tries to jump the stile basically and say, I'm coming in, and someone steps in and someone dies, and they're bound over to keep the peace, and it's all quietly never heard about again.
And there are other examples of just the difficulties that are on tour. There's cases of companies going to guild halls and not filtering through the audience well enough, so someone dies in a crush, or the building is damaged. So they make this money from that night's performance, and then they're told, okay, now you owe us that money to repair the door. It really gives you an impression of how fragile the security and the stability of these companies really could be. Yeah, the Queen's Men are an extreme example. But Pembroke's Men going bust is not an extreme example. That's perfectly understandable. And then there's companies turning up and being driven out of town. It's a very difficult life to lead on the road. So as we said earlier, you'd need people who were capable of touring but also willing to tour. Especially under these circumstances, I could perfectly understand why you might want to avoid it.
And not everyone is receptive. You might turn up into a town and find that actually there's a very vocal opposition to your arrival, and that can go a bit wrong. And what sort of local opposition is there for hosting this kind of drama?
Absolute favorite Anthony Munday quote. Wonderful Anthony Munday made his living through such a large chunk of his living through the theatres, and he complains about traveling players performing in churches. He says they're turning the sanctuary into a den of thieves and adulterers, which he doesn't mince his words in that regard. But the records I've delved most deeply into are, of course, the Stratford records, and one of the reasons we know that this building was the preferred performance venue in Stratford is because there's an ever-growing faction on the town council who want to put a stop to this. We have an attempt in 1602 which says any member of the town council who permits people to perform in the guild hall will be fined. That then moves up a little bit in 1604 when a clarification is issued that says that please note justices of the peace cannot give special dispensation for players to perform in the Stratford Guild Hall. Then you get into 1611 when someone else is saying, we're now going to fine you £2 if you let players perform in the Guild Hall. We shouldn't be letting this happen. And that's then altered down to 20 shillings in 1612. But the same sentiment is there. Don't perform in the Guild Hall. We don't want you here. And finally, the very last record of a company coming to Stratford is 1622, when the King's men turn up and are actually paid compensation for being forbidden from entering the Guildhall. So you can see, as time is going on, opposition is an ever-growing thing. It takes a while because there's obviously this conflict on the council where some people are obviously still letting people perform in the Guildhall. If they weren't, you wouldn't need to keep reissuing the banning orders and increasing the level of the fine. Until eventually that succeeds. But that could also be a reason why touring theatre, one of the many reasons why touring theatre seems to gradually die out as we get through the 1590s and into the early 17th century. Because, you know, if there's so much opposition outside of London, if provincial England is becoming increasingly Puritan, is there any point? You know, are you going to just be turned away from more places than you'll be accepted?
And it's
if you're being told you're thieves and adulterers.
Yeah, it's that slow creep of disincentives. It's not quite the same as say with mystery playing, for example. You know, where it didn't disappear overnight, and yes, you know, it slowly is eroded away by a sort of official opposition. But people keep trying to do it and keep trying to do it, and as time goes on, it just gets that bit too much like hard work to do it again. And I wonder whether that sort of dying off is partly, I said earlier, that idea of a memory of being in plays, being still slightly alive towards the, you know, during Elizabeth's reign, and that slowly dies out as the new generations come in. But also as London theatre becomes so London-centric, is the playing companies from the 1580s onwards seem to be going, this is where we're at. We're going to be pitching what we're doing to the court, and some big companies are making that sort of that attempt to grab the zeitgeist, and the touring circuit, it's not their primary interest, and it's not necessarily where the printer's interest is, and the money to go there isn't as good as the incentive to stay in London. Yeah. So it's not one thing, it's a whole series of interlocking things that just slowly over time erodes everything. Is that a reasonable way of looking?
And I think it would erode. I mean, like, as we said, it's a precarious existence on the road. If you're constantly coming up against these things that are affecting your livelihood and they feel like tenuous opposition, such as in Faversham, there's a record of a company being fined substantially because someone disagreed with where they parked their cart during the performance. And then you get records in Stratford. I mean, in Stratford, you have 25, I think it's 25 of those 35 visits occur between 1568 and 1587. And then after that, it's 1592, 1597, 1618, 1620, 1622. So it's just sharp falling off. But also, one of the things I find quite interesting is that these increasingly extravagant special effects in plays seem to sort of arise around the time that touring theatre is dying off. And I do wonder whether playing companies are thinking, you know, we can have Jove appear in a cloud of smoke and dazzle everyone because we're not going to be taking this scene on tour. We can use more elaborate staging requirements and costumes and have bigger crowds in our plays and all of that, because London is becoming preferable. And people are still going on tour. There's still records up to the 1630s of people on tour. But those later records, we usually know about those visits because it's a record of someone saying, and we chased them out of town because they were bringing Satan into our midst.
And when the Civil War comes, there's so much disruption at that point that, you know, it's the economics of the business model just falls out, you know, even if there wasn't a battle happening next door. And there isn't the money either, because the economy takes a massive hit at the same time. So anything keeping going. I love this idea, going back to something you said earlier, of we thought we'd locked the players out, and you know, Barry, did you let them in again? We're gonna have to find him. We're gonna have to find him next time.
Yeah, if you read between the lines of those Stratford banning orders, it basically is stop doing it.
Yeah,
but someone let it happen again. Really, stop. No, please stop. You can't give permission to do it. Stop doing it. If you do it again, I'm going to charge you £2. Okay, people said that's unfair. So I'm going to find you 20 shillings instead. That's fair. Okay, just go away. It's easy if you just go. It's too much hassle for us.
It reminds us of how we know that theatre continued even though the Christian Church turned against it. After the fall of the Roman Empire, because it's just if a pope has to keep saying stop doing it, you know it's happening. Yeah. We've got a couple of little questions from the chat before we close off. The plays with specific local settings like Arden of Faversham and Lancashire Witches. Do we think Do they think that Faversham wants to be reminded of the hideous murder that was committed there 50 years earlier?
It's such a popular story at the time. It's been retold in ballads and broadsheets, and of course this play. I do wonder whether this happened. I think if I was going on tour and I know I was going to Faversham and I own that play, yeah, put it on. People are going to come and see it. But the problem is, I would say almost 99% of the time, they don't tell us what play was being performed. So even if we knew the company for Arden of Faversham, it would just say that company turned up or worse, players had turned up. So we don't have these records of, and they played this. Mm. If you're touring and there's a play that has specific local interest, if you're going on tour and you've got a history play that has a character in it who's the ancestor of a really big local aristocratic influential figure, I could definitely see that being put on. It makes sense. It makes economic sense. You're always going to be looking for ways to maximise your earnings.
So we have run out of time. I just ask you to do a little plug for the thing that is coming up in the future. For those listening to the podcast, this may be happening now and it may have happened in the past. So do check the show links for whether this is still a thing. But anyway, Will, tell us what's going on at the Stratford-upon-Avon Guildhall.
Well, it's permanent, so hopefully we're aiming for by the end of January, there will be a new permanent exhibition curated by me, which will be set up focusing on the Stratford-upon-Avon Guildhall as a venue for regional theatre in the 16th and 17th centuries. It's going to have a wonderful information board, and there'll be some digital content as well, some video content. The museum within the Guildhall, put the duck away, it's called Shakespeare's Schoolroom and Guildhall. That is the name of the place. It is okay. The building's use as a regional theatre venue, an exhibition on touring theatre in early modern England and early modern Warwickshire, specifically opening hopefully in January. So please do come along if you happen to be in the neighbourhood or fancy making the trip. It'll be a permanent exhibition, as I say, so as long as the museum exists, which we hope is forever, it will be there. So do come along, and I hope it lives up to my expectations. But it should open in January.
So all that remains is thank Will for being such a wonderful guest. Thank you once again, and goodbye.